As everybody says, it's a great pleasure to be here. It really is. I came to Yale originally in 1962. I was here the last year we were in Kirtland Hall. I was here before Brian Skinner.
That's not possible.
But Carl Tarikian was on the faculty then. And in fact, Carl was so terrifying in those days that I was the only person who was crazy enough to actually play him in Dana Club skits at that time. It's really fun to be here. I'm going to raise a new discipline area, but I would like to remind everybody that paleontology, which is now often called paleobiology, is really also should be known as geobiology. It's really the third aspect of the geosciences, along with geophysics and geochemistry. When you get in geobiology, then you get how all of the different aspects of natural world and natural processes affect the Earth. I'm going to be talking about what I call the change in the use of ecospace in the marine realm over time. This will be a grand arm waver. We'll move from a scale of centuries and millennia to half a billion years or so, and we're going to have about four data points, one about 550 million years ago, one 500, you know, that sort of thing, to take a look at. Started working on this, really inspired by G. Evelyn Hutchinson over in who was in Osborne. He was in biology. I took courses over there as well as in geology. And Lee McAllister, who actually had some interesting diagrams in some of his introductory books that he wrote. And I brought from thinking about the nature of the way organisms use space or ecological conditions, and how you structure the ecosystem. And I brought the guild concept from biology into paleontology, and it was a grand idea, but it was wrong in most cases. My efforts to sort of get all the dimensions of life, my bow plan or body plan ideas, were just too arbitrary and vague. I could say, well, this group of things because of that is different from that group of things because of this. It was subjective, not objective. Food source is not always determinable, though the way things eat can be determined very often in the fossil record. And my idea of space utilization was too broad. I mixed the way organisms function or act and where they live. One of the real lessons for this is you should have good graduate students. I had a very bright young man do a master's with me at Virginia Tech, and he then went up to Harvard. I caught up with him after I retired at Tech and moved to Harvard, and he decided to try to make sense out of my old ideas. And so Andy Bush, who is now on the faculty at the University of Connecticut, by the way, is really should be a co-author on this whole discussion. Almost all the work is something I've done in collaboration with him. He set up an improved methodology for doing paleoecologic assessment, in which we dealt with three axes: tiering, which is where you live relative to the sediment-water interface in the oceans, the sea bottom; motility level, whether you can move or not and how you do that; and the feeding strategy, the way in which every organism has to acquire nutrients and how you do it. These things can usually be determined by functional morphology and the way the organisms look, even if you don't know what kind of things they are. If you see their form, you can usually tell what they were doing. And Steve Stanley and people like that were pioneers in really making that aspect of interpretation important. One of the things we do with this process when we work with individual fossil assemblages is we also count things so that we can really do some quantitative analysis, which again brings a kind of rigor into the system which just describing things doesn't do. So these three axes create what we call our ecospace cube, and if you categorize things properly, you can actually designate how everything can possibly work. For instance, if you look at our feeding strategies, you come over to the last one there, other, that means that we cover everything. And so this is an attempt to really categorize a priori all the possible ways in which organisms can function in these three different systems. It means that you can have combinations of the three axes to make 216, if you divide each one up into each axis into six units, 216 combinations, which we will call modes of life. And so these would be all the possible modes of life. One of the things you want to do then is figure out, you know, how does this work in the real world? So I spent several months in the Smithsonian Library plowing through all the literature on marine invertebrates. It's really tough. And the thing that I found most interesting was I came up with, I was able, working with everything from worms to whales, to document 92 of these possible 216 modes of life. But that's all I could find in the recent. There were 26 others that I think are possible and reasonable, but I never found documentation of them, though that may be my fault. But I do think that 98 of these possible, and they're theoretically possible, you can imagine an organism doing any one of them, 45% of them are probably unlikely to be successful simply because other things could outcompete them, if you will, or run them off from the system. A giraffe-like thing walking on the seafloor but digging in the sediment to get deposit buried food would be a stupid way to make a living. That sort of thing, something we would call an erect, motile mining deposit feeder, doesn't exist. Anyway, we're dealing with only about half of the possible modes of life ever having been realized. Now, this includes all the kinds of organisms, and if we're going to do paleontology, we have to worry about what can get preserved. And so I also categorized with the nine phyla, which have an extensive fossil record, and looked at representatives of those that I had found with various modes of life. And I came up with 82 of the 92 documented modes of life just in those, so that when we're dealing with things where we have soft-bodied preservation, we might be able to see as many as 82 modes of life. And then dealing only with the classes which have heavy skeletons, have easily preserved as mineralized tissues, the things that are commonly found as fossils. It turned out that 62 of these realized modes of life are actually represented by things which have good skeletons and could easily be preserved. People have looked, for instance, at the genus level that we'd work at most of the time. They've looked at this with living organisms that have these heavy skeletons, and 100% of the snails and bivalves, for instance, the clams, have a fossil record of those genera in faunas people have studied recently. So this is going to be something we can sort of count on. Well, let's look at this through time. And here on the upper part of this diagram are the three Ediacaran faunas, and they're virtually empty. Not quite, but almost. People like Xuhai Zhao have actually said this is a reasonable way to interpret these modes of life, so I feel fairly secure on this. There are only 12 of the modes of life represented in the Ediacaran fauna in general, and at maximum in the White Sea subfauna, only 10. And so the world starts out with rather few things, and we need to fill ecospace. And that's what's happened, as we can see on the lower left, is the lower and middle Cambrian, and that includes the Qingjiang and Burgess Shale faunas, so that includes the soft-bodied faunas that are so well-preserved frequently back in the early and middle Cambrian, as well as the skeletal fauna. 18 of these modes of life that are filled in are skeletal, and the others 12 of the 30 that are preserved there are from soft-bodied things only. This contrasts, again, with the modern fauna of 82 commonly preserved kinds of organisms. So we've filled ecospace during the Phanerozoic after the Cambrian explosion. So there's a major change from the first animals in the late Precambrian and the Ediacaran to the Cambrian, and a further change after that. In the upper diagram here, you can see the number of modes per sort of category going across in tearing, motility, and feeding. And there has been an increase, you can see, from the Ediacaran up to the blue, which is the Cambrian, and then the black and gray are the recent. You can see there's been an increase in modes of life in each little category through time. So we have been filling ecospace. The thing that's really key on this, and this is something that's in review right now or in press, is the bottom diagram, which takes the middle one, which is just sort of a wuzzle, and sorts it out by really taking the first differences from the Ediacaran fauna. And we see a rather interesting phenomenon, which is that the Cambrian and the recent fauna have a pattern which is very similar and entirely different in terms of common and rare modes of life compared to the Ediacaran. So Dolph Seilacher may be right. The Ediacaran fauna is something different than the animals that have characterized the fossil record from the Cambrian to now. Used ecospace entirely differently. The filling of ecospace with what we might call the normal fossil record is one of adding modes of life. Here we've taken the Ordovician after both the Cambrian radiation and the Ordovician radiation, and these are skeletal things only. So remember, back in the Cambrian, we only had 18 skeletal modes of life recorded in the skeletal fauna. So we've added some in the skeletal fauna by the time we get into the late Ordovician. But that contrasts with 30 skeletal modes of life represented by skeletal organisms in the Ordovician, with the 62 that are likely to be preserved in the Cenozoic. And so we have doubled the number of modes of life during the Phanerozoic as well. We want to take that comparison and think about how ecosystems themselves are structured. And here we're going to take a set of data that Andy Bush and I have worked on in a series of papers since 2004, in which we take 79 different middle Paleozoic assemblages, which are well-described, large assemblages where we have counts on specimens, and we have over 100 specimens in each one of these 80 or 79 things. Compare that with late Cenozoic things. So we're dealing with the fossil record exclusively here. And we have temperate, almost 50 temperate samples, and courtesy of Jeremy Jackson and the Panama Paleo Project, the Molluscan data for 235 tropical Cenozoic assemblages. The importance of the tropical versus temperate is in the middle Paleozoic. All of our data are from what were paleogeographically tropical systems at that time. When we look at rarefaction curves, which is a way of comparing samples of different sizes, and you work back to what would be the same size samples in each, when we're at 200 specimens in the Paleozoic, we have an average of about 12.5 genera in our samples. In the late Cenozoic temperate system, 24. So there's nearly a doubling of diversity. This is just simply the number of different kinds of things in from the Paleozoic to the late Cenozoic. And everybody knows that diversity has increased over that time. When you throw in the tropical samples, you get up to 50 genera at 400 specimens, and you're well ahead. So definitely the Cenozoic is much more diverse at the ecosystem level as the Paleozoic. However, when we then look at the number of modes of life represented in those assemblages, those individual assemblages and the averages for them, rarefying the number of specimens, it turns out in the Paleozoic assemblages, we end up at 200 specimens with about 5 to 5.5 modes of life represented, whereas in the Cenozoic, with double the number of genera almost, we have 9.5 modes of life. So there's clearly a relationship between diversity and the number of modes of life. And it's interesting that the lower diagram here is the number of species or genera within each mode of life, and it's about the same in the Paleozoic and the Cenozoic. So that increase in number of genera within assemblages is there in part because there's an increase in the number of modes of life. When we look at the number of modes of life represented by the assemblages we're studying, now this is not all the possible modes of life that we've detected at these times, but just within this one habitat system. That habitat system is what we call the level bottom marine community. It's loose sediment bottoms, muds and sands, but loose sediment, not reefs and not rocky shores and things like that, just the loose sediment, we end up with the modes of life, as you can see on these diagrams, where on the left, the Paleozoic, and then the tropical and temperate Cenozoic in the middle and right. But there are 21 modes of life represented in those Paleozoic assemblages, and only 23 to 25 in the Cenozoic assemblages. That raises a real question. If there are 21 to 25 modes of life represented in both the mid-Paleozoic and the late Cenozoic in the level bottom ecosystems, how then on average can you have almost twice as many modes of life in the late Cenozoic as you have in the Paleozoic assemblages on average? The answer, of course, is in abundance. It turns out in the Paleozoic, you not only have, you may have 21 modes of life in this general habitat system, but 80% of the individuals, when you pool all your samples, 80% of the individuals utilize just two of those modes of life. And they are, in effect, brachiopods and bryozoans, attached to the seafloor, non-motile, on the surface of the seafloor, growing up off of it in the case of bryozoans. And that's it for most of these things. Whereas in the Cenozoic temperate system, six modes of life contain 75% of the individuals. And for the Cenozoic tropical system, 80% of the individuals are distributed amongst seven dominant modes of life. This means that if you're just simply selecting from these assemblage groups as species pools, if you're drawing in the Paleozoic because of the dominance of just two modes of life, four out of five individuals you would select are in one of two modes of life, and you very rarely get one of the other modes of life. Whereas in the Cenozoic, you're going to draw from five or six modes of life almost equally likely and add some others as well. Now, this means then that there may not be anything structuring these assemblages other than just simply the abundances of the organisms in the species pool. However, when we look at these abundances and which modes of life are common, since there was a shift from only two dominant modes of life to a number of them, we see some interesting differences. In the level bottom marine system, there has been a major increase in organisms that burrow into the sediment. Back in the Paleozoic, there were rather few. Now they're very abundant, as common or commoner than things that live on the surface. We have a major increase in motile organisms, things that can move around. Remember, brachiopods and bryozoans don't move. They just sit there. But almost all these things move around. And yet they're doing that, and of course with that there's been a great loss of things that are non-motile in the level bottom system. In feeding, there has been an increase in predation. So there has been a change in the nature of the ecosystems, even though there may not have been much change in the way in which organisms actually are assembled into assemblages. These next couple of slides I'm going to skip past quickly. I'll just give you one particular point here, which is that the red on this one is randomizing the occurrences of modes of life for our assemblages, and it's exactly the same distribution of the number of modes of life and genera. In fact, assemblages are simply random selections from the total species pool. And in conclusion, I'll just leave you with the fact that though from the early Cambrian and middle Cambrian to now, we have added many modes of life, and you can see there's been a shift over to the right as we've changed some of these things. We can come through and say that we've changed the nature of the ecosystem, but we're doing this on a regional or global basis. All environments are having the same kinds of events, and that local assemblages, something biologists have not understood, are apparently simply random accumulations of the local species available. There are some questions we now have to answer. And that's for the future. What has been the actual course of change, interval by interval, over time? We don't know yet. We've just taken a look at different times to see if there is a difference. There is. Is the change between them episodic, or is it continuous? We don't know. Are there modifications in ecospace use at major events such as mass extinctions or major geochemical anomalies or climate shifts? That leaves a big area for a lot of dissertations to find out something about that. And then, are there biotic controls on local assemblage structure not visible with this rather coarse parsing of ecospace utilization? Thank you.
Thank you. As with previous sessions, we'll hold off on